Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. Today on the show, we're doing a deep dive into medical aid in dying. We're going to explain what medical aid in dying is, how long it's been legal in Vermont, and the changes to the law over time. We're also going to hear the story of a Connecticut cancer patient who is suing Vermont over the law's residency requirements. To start, medical aid in dying has been legal in Vermont since 2013 when lawmakers passed Act 39. At that time, Vermont was the third state to make it law, but the first state to do it by legislative process. Today, there are 11 jurisdictions across the country that allow medical aid in dying, and most have residency requirements. This means people interested in being prescribed the end-of-life medication must live in that particular jurisdiction. However, a new lawsuit hopes to change the residency requirement in Vermont. We'll discuss that with a patient, doctor, and attorney. Now, to give you background and get you caught up, the law in short says Vermont physicians can prescribe medication to a Vermont resident with a terminal condition with the intent that that medication be voluntarily self-administered for the purpose of speeding up the patient's death. The medication itself is taken without the doctor's help. Now, listeners, what questions do you have about medical aid in dying? Has this issue affected you or your family? Do you think the law should be expanded to include non-residents? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can also tweet us at Vermont Edition or send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, one of the people looking to expand Vermont's law is Linda Bluestein. She's 75 years old and lives in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Linda, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Now, Linda, I want to just start by thanking you for being so vulnerable with us today and taking the time to share with our listeners what you've been going through. I really appreciate you taking the time. That can't be easy.
It's not easy, but this is so important to me. So I thank you for giving this particular issue your time on your show, especially in Vermont.
Well, so let's just get started. And I'm hoping you can just start by telling us a little bit about your history with cancer and your current diagnosis.
Okay, my history with cancer goes back to 2018 when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I had a lumpectomy in November of 2018 that was not sufficient to stop the breast cancer. So in January of 2019, I had bilateral mastectomies. A few months later, I was diagnosed with malignant melanoma and had yet another cancer surgery that was a wide excision of a melanoma on my shoulder. Then I thought I was through everything and I was feeling quite good and looking forward to life. The pandemic hit. And then in 2021, when I was sure that we were going to getting back to life as normal, I was diagnosed with end-stage fallopian tube cancer, my third cancer diagnosis in 2 years. And at that moment, I realized that I am indeed following my mother, who also had three individual cancer diagnoses and died a death that she would not have wanted for herself, and certainly I don't want for myself. So that's when I began getting really serious about medical aid in dying for my own choices at the end of my life.
Do these conversations about death and dying, do they get easier for you over time, or are they still hard?
They're getting very much easier as I am easing into acceptance of not only the inevitability of death, which we all know is out there somewhere, but the realization that this is going to come a lot sooner than I had hoped. I love my life. I don't want to die, but I don't want to suffer and at the end of my life. I'd like to choose how my final days are going to look. And that's why I am seeking out this change in Vermont's residency requirements, because I will move to Vermont at the end of my life, to have that assurance that when the suffering gets to be too great for me, and when my life is so horrible that I don't want to wake up the next morning, that I will have that option, that I will give me a tremendous amount of peace and comfort in a situation that, you know, I didn't really want. I don't think anybody would want what I have.
Right. And I'm just curious, have the doctors given you any idea of how much time you have left or what this means for the rest of your life?
Well, we have only statistics, and statistics mean, you know, not very much. I was first diagnosed, I thought I would have 6 months and then a year, year and a half. Maybe I have another year. I don't know if I do. I hope I do. And today I will be meeting with my medical oncologist later this afternoon, and we're going to talk about some PET scans that I had yesterday, which may give me a clearer picture of what I can expect in the next few months.
Now, in the intro, I talked about the law, and I was on purpose very technical because I want to make sure we stick to the facts and give the right information. But you're someone who's fighting the law, so I'm wondering if you, in your own words, can describe what the law means to you, how it's currently written.
Okay. My understanding of the law comes from a very close friend of mine who was in a cancer support group with me a couple of years ago. And earlier this year, last December, she moved to Vermont to access Act 39. So on December 2nd, she left Fairfield, Connecticut, drove to Vermont, and she wrote me emails, two or three emails each week, to tell me exactly how complicated it was going to be were I to want to follow in her footsteps and go to Vermont. She had to send packages to herself. She had to change the registration on her car, register to vote, rent a place to live. There were a lot of things that she had to do just to show that she was a Vermont resident. And then it got more complicated, and she would write emails. She said, now you have to have all of your medical records sent from your doctors in Connecticut, and they have to go to a doctor in Vermont. Doctor number one had to agree with your doctors in Connecticut that yes, you have 6 months or less to live, and there's no treatment available for you. Then you wait 2 weeks, then you have to send the records again to a second physician who also has to certify that you are hospice eligible, which would make you eligible for Act 39 in Vermont. Now, that's a lot to do when you are in the last 6 months of your life. And when my friend Kathy was suffering from lung cancer, it was extremely difficult. Then she had to find two witnesses who would talk to her that didn't know her. She met someone in a coffee shop, and she sat down and explained why she had moved to Vermont and what she wanted, and that she was in her right mind, and she knew what she was very clear about her beliefs, her wants, and have that person sign that form. Then she had to find a second unattached person who she met in a bookstore. And she then had to tell her whole story again. And then she had to find a place to have someone take care of her, because she was finding it very difficult to even walk or get food in the place she had rented. So what it means to have the residency requirement is to be at the end of your life, to have cancer taking more and more of yourself away every day, your energy, your ability to function, and you have a lot of complicated things to step through in order to meet the residency requirement before you're able to access the medication at a pharmacy, and then now gather your family and friends back in Vermont who are coming from far distances to be with you so that you can choose a time when you can, as my friend Kathy said, take flight. That's a lot.
Now, earlier you had mentioned that you are planning on moving to Vermont. What would you be leaving behind?
My entire network of support, everything I love in Connecticut, my home, my dog, my gardens, my friends, my neighbors, my church, my doctors, my support group. I mean, what does anyone leave when they move out of state?
Yeah, that, I mean, I can't imagine, like, what were those conversations like, you know, when you were talking to your family and discussing, you know, medical aid and dying and weighing the pros and cons of possibly moving to Vermont? How did your family respond? And, you know, what were those conversations like?
My family has been very supportive. My husband is a physician, and he has always been an advocate of medical aid and dying and has been working with Compassion and Choices in Connecticut, trying to urge this legislation similar to Act 39 to be passed in Connecticut. Both my husband and I have testified at state at hearings in Connecticut, but we've been unsuccessful thus far. My adult son and my adult daughter understand how important it is to me to live up till the very end the way I want to live. And that includes choosing the time when I say, enough, cancer, you've had too much of my life, and be able to access medical aid in dying.
Is that the most important reason why medical aid in dying is important to you, is to claim control of how you end your life?
Absolutely. My own life has been changed by cancer, these three different diagnoses and lots of surgery, lots of chemotherapy, drugs, all kinds of side effects. But I accept the inevitability of my own death. And I want expanded options for compassionate dying. And the kind of dying that my mother and my father experienced was anything but compassionate. My mother was very embarrassed and in pain and in agony, and she didn't want to have her last conversation with me being moaning and in excruciating pain. Nor do I want my last conversations with my beloveds to be like that.
So you're part of this lawsuit against Vermont seeking the right to access medical aid in dying. Right now, because you aren't a Vermont resident, you can't legally access it because, as we've talked about, you live in Connecticut, which doesn't have such a law. How did you decide, and maybe why did you decide, to spend what limited time doctors are predicting you have battling this lawsuit?
It's the one last thing I can do with my one precious life I've been given. I've always been an activist. I've been involved in many, many causes over my life. And now this one impacts me and impacts very dear friends of mine. You know, when you have cancer and you're going to chemotherapy every day and you're going to support groups, you meet other people who are also in stage of their lives, and they want the same thing. I'm doing this for my friends. I'm doing this for neighbors, a neighbor who has breast cancer, stage 4. I'm doing this for another dear friend who's just had a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. I'm doing it because I can, and I have a unique voice to offer to this lawsuit, I believe.
And then for our listeners who maybe haven't experienced much death, can you help us understand what you think is the alternative to medical aid in dying? How you might die if you don't have this option?
Oh, yes, I do. I have lots of options if I don't access medical aid in dying. I can voluntarily stop eating and drinking and starve myself to death. I can stop treatment immediately and just let the cancer take over and have its way with all of my body systems. I can use so much palliative sedation, you know, my little bottles of morphine and my pills that I have in my medicine cabinet of oxycodone, and try to do it myself. I don't want to be my own doctor. I don't want to drink the bottle of morphine that I have. And I would rather envision my death as how I lived, to have my beloveds gathered around me, that we can laugh and we can talk and we can share stories. And then I can have a cocktail that's been prescribed by a doctor that will do the job, so that I'm not going to be throwing up and then surviving my own, you know, I don't want to be my own doctor in this. I really need someone to make sure that the prescription that I take will make it possible for me to go to sleep and have my wish, not wake up tomorrow morning.
So you've already, I presume, with your family have decided that if medical aid in dying is not an option, that you are going to take control of your end of life.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and that kind of brings me to another point that, you know, some religions are opposed to medical aid in dying. For example, the Catholic Church considers it to be against what is considered to be God's gift to life. Do you consider yourself a spiritual person?
I am a woman of faith. I believe that everyone has the right to choose the end of life care that reflects their values, their priorities, and their beliefs. Medical aid in dying reflects my values, which is to live as fully as I can until that's no longer possible. My values that I have the loved ones with me and that we have the important conversation, and my beliefs, and I am a Unitarian Universalist, and the Unitarian Universalist faith is very supportive of agency at end of life decision-making for the individual. It's not saying everyone should choose this. It's saying if that is what you and in your discernment has come up with as consistent with all of your values and beliefs, then you should have that right.
What advice do you have or do you give to people who are considering it and who have family members who maybe don't understand it or maybe are just now learning about this?
Well, we share among ourselves books that family members could read. We also, each of us, make a death plan, and we talk about what we want at the end of life and the kinds of things that are of most importance to us, because it's after all, it's our deaths. And I urge them to, you know, share their deepest motivations about what they want. But ultimately, it's their life, their choice.
I now want to introduce the Middlebury physician who's also a plaintiff in the lawsuit, Dr. Diana Barnard. Dr. Barnard, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The lawsuit was filed by the national advocacy group Compassion and Choices on your behalf. Vermont's governor, attorney general, health commissioner, and the head of the board of the medical practice were named as defendants. And listeners, I want to let you know, we did reach out to the Vermont Attorney General's office, which is responsible for defending the state's law. They confirmed that they did receive the complaint and are reviewing it. They said that they were not able to comment beyond that at this time. Now, Dr. Barnard, you practice medicine in Middlebury. Can you start by telling us what type of medicine you practice and how you became an advocate for medical aid in dying?
I am a family medicine doctor by training, and I have additional board certification in hospice and palliative medicine. And that is additional training and certification that I undertook because my many years of practice as a family medicine doctor showed me that our system was not adequately meeting the needs of those living with serious illness. And as I've journeyed more into the practice of remaining humble and curious and listening to my patients and their needs, it became clear that we need more tools, that there are more options that we need to help support people and their individual values and priorities at the most tender time in life.
And we got an email from Diane, and they emailed us to say, can you discuss the need for medical aid in dying versus hospice care at the end of life? How do these compare in meeting the needs of the patients at such a vulnerable time?
That's a wonderful question. I would say that hospice care is the gold standard for being the best way to support people. This is a situation of and. So I am a self-described hospice junkie. I believe everybody should have access to hospice. We also know that many people face unique situations and experience suffering, whether it is physical or existential. that is difficult to manage. I think in medicine, we've come to recognize that we need many tools in our toolbox. So hospice is a wonderful service and everybody should have access to it. And even with hospice support, there are times when individual patients are telling us that they are suffering. And I believe that we should have many options and many tools to be able to address an individual patient's suffering.
And Dr. Barnard, we just heard Linda's story about not living in Vermont, but still wanting to access medical aid in dying. How does her story compare or contrast to other patients of yours?
Well, first of all, I want to really thank you for your wisdom in starting the show with Linda, because at the end of the day, this isn't about lawyers and it really isn't about doctors. It is about patients and listening to what they need and what they're asking for and what they want. And I believe Linda's story is actually, you know, quite a common one in terms of people who are living with serious illness, and in Linda's case, unfortunately, several serious illnesses. As our medical system has evolved, we have actually done a wonderful job of helping people live longer despite having serious illness, and that is a wonderful thing. It also is true that living longer and with more advanced disease causes at times more suffering. And what we want to do is to be able to manage that suffering and really listen to our patients. So Linda's story is quite typical, and she is not the only person that I have had contact with over the years who happens to live in another state who desperately wants to have this as an option. And I believe it is part of my responsibility. Like Linda, I have a voice, I have a passion, I have a mission, and my job is to bring the patient's voice and their wishes to the table.
And Linda, you're still on the line with us, so I want to bring you back into the conversation, and I want to ask, what is it that you need from the medical system right now?
The truth, understanding of what my wishes are. Mostly, I want to know the truth, and it's sometimes it's hard to get because people say, just stay positive, you know, things are going to be all right. This is a little concerning. Well, what is a little concerning me? I'd like to know more details because that's who I am.
And Dr. Barnard, you talked about, you know, palliative care. Can you explain what palliative care is and how it's helping change the medical profession?
Sure. Palliative care is a relatively new specialty that really is trying to take the positive aspects of hospice care, which include attending to suffering, using an interdisciplinary team, meeting the patients where they are, doing everything that you can do to make every day of living as good as it can be right up until people start to die, and bringing that care to people much earlier in their illness. So palliative care is a supportive service that works with people who are living with serious illness, regardless of their diagnosis and where they are in their treatment realm. So many people that I meet are still pursuing curative treatments and hope that their disease will go away, as I do also. And we attend to suffering and support them throughout their disease process.
We got an email from Jude, and they write, I invited my almost ex-husband from Virginia to move to Vermont because of Death with Dignity and medical marijuana. He established residency here. However, I do not believe that should be a prerequisite. This is one of the most compassionate laws Vermont has passed. Because of Death with Dignity, my husband was able to say this was the best year of his life, even though I reminded him it was 22 months. They continue to say freedom over our bodies should be a given. So, Dr. Barnard, I'm wondering, how much control can you tell patients they have over their bodies if they can't control their end of life?
Yeah, this is an interesting situation. They're navigating our lives and our health brings with it a lot of uncertainty. And I don't think we always completely appreciate that, that even though we might have ideas about how we want to live or how we want to die, none of us can truly know what decisions we will make until it is our time and based on our experience. And I think, you know, one of the most important messages for today's show is really that dying is universal, but it does not have to be scary, and it should not have to be including of a lot of suffering. That if we can have open dialogue and if we can have many tools available to us, we can really help support people in living fully right till the very end.
And listeners, right now we are speaking about medical aid and dying. What are your questions about it? What are your experiences with it? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Let's go to Janet in North Springfield. Janet, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a former hospice nurse. I worked with the VNA for years. And I want to say I fully support the right to make your own decisions as far as dying. Personally, I think I would choose the right to die when the time came. However, I think the lady on the phone that's discussing from Connecticut moving to Vermont for the purpose of controlling her own death is kind of futile, in that hospice care can keep someone absolutely comfortable, relatively pain-free to the very end. I've experienced this time and time again with people in the community. My own father, prior to when Medicare was actually paying for hospice care in the Philadelphia area, was alert and pain-free until his almost his last breath, and he was in a Quaker hospice. This poor lady in Connecticut, I feel bad for her. If she moves to Vermont, yes, she has a choice and makes residency in Vermont. She has a choice of doing her own death. However, she's leaving behind all of that community that's there to support her.
Janet, thank you so much for that call. Dr. Barnard, I want to start with you and address one of the things that Janet said, which was that people can die comfortably in hospice care. Is that a universal experience?
As I mentioned before, hospice is absolutely the gold standard for addressing the complex needs of those who are living with an illness in its terminal phase. And for many people, standard hospice care will meet their needs and they will be able to have a peaceful death. That is really, really important for your listeners to understand. It's also important for us to be honest and to recognize that illnesses can be so complex, and that for a small and significant number of people, they experience suffering, whether it is physical pain or existential distress at the threat to their personhood that makes their suffering impossible to adequately manage. The fact that where this process is legal, where medical aid in dying is legal, it accounts for less than 1% of the deaths. So this is a good reminder that we all want to live. Most of the patients that I see want to live as long and as well as possible. Most of my patients are open to the support of hospice and want hospice to be able to manage their symptoms. And we need to be honest that there are sometimes limits to what we can do to address suffering, and also to acknowledge the deeply individual nature of suffering, and to, again, remain humble and curious and listen to what our patients want and need, and have these additional tools available when the standard of care and hospice care alone is not enough.
And listeners, for, I guess, context, since 2013 in Vermont, just over 100 people have accessed this law of medical aid in dying. And Linda, I want to bring you back into the conversation. As a cancer patient, What do pain meds mean to you and having that be how you end your life?
Pain meds and I are not friends. I have had 4 shoulder surgeries and was prescribed opioids for all of them, and they did not relieve my pain. I have a very bad history with having anesthesia and throwing up and being very ill, with having pain medications not relieve my pain. And that increases my fear. I'm one of those for whom you can't be comfortable. And I have been in palliative care since I was admitted to Smilo Cancer Hospital in New Haven last year. A palliative care physician was assigned to me immediately, and I have stayed with palliative care. I meet every couple of weeks with a social worker. I had a rabbi who was my chaplain. I have a palliative care doctor who has made it possible for me to access medical marijuana. Those are all wonderful things, and I can't say enough about palliative care and how important it is to my mental well-being, but it doesn't take away the fear that I know that when I have really bad pain, nothing seems to help.
I want to go back to the phones and listeners. If you want to join the conversation, if you have a story you want to share or just thoughts or opinions about medical aid and dying, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Zena and Barry. Zena, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I want to raise a sort of systemic question about why I expect this law to be used a lot more. The fact that because of the opioid overdose crisis, doctors no longer are treating pain the way they used to, and a lot of people end up in a lot of pain and nothing can be done. I'm in my 70s. I don't have a terminal condition, but I expect when that occurs, I will want to use that law as well. I know that a lot of people are really not getting good pain because of this desire, understandably, of doctors to not be blamed for overprescribing. But a very bad example, there was this young man who had back surgery and it didn't relieve his pain, and he went absolutely bonkers and got a couple of guns and did a mass shooting in the hospital where he was treated, starting with the doctor who did his back surgery. And
Zena, I'm sorry to jump in right here, but I'm just wondering, do you have a question?
I guess.
Well, I think it. Yeah. Well, let's just. I mean, let's just talk. We'll talk about. Thank you for your call, Zena. And Dr. Barnard, I want to go to you. One of the things that Zena just brought up was about access to pain medication and how people who don't have terminally ill conditions are struggling to get it because physicians are scared or are just not prescribing it the way they used to. How does that relate to people who have terminal conditions? And do you think that we should expand the law to include people without terminal conditions?
No, I do not believe the law should be expanded to include those without terminal conditions. And I want to just acknowledge that pain is a complex symptom, and that medicine is complicated. The tools we use are complicated. And unfortunately, opioids, which are a very powerful tool and a good tool when used appropriately in the right situation, unfortunately, we've also learned from practical experience that they can be misused. And so I just want to acknowledge that it's a complicated issue. And again, in medicine, it's an and situation. We need to be better at managing pain for those living with serious illness and who have a terminal condition. We also need to be better at managing pain for those without a terminal condition. And I fully support more research and more resources into helping everyone who's living with pain be able to live their life more fully.
I now want to bring in a legal perspective. Joining us is attorney Ronald Shems, a partner in the Montpelier law firm Tarrant, Giles, and Shems. He's the local counsel to Compassion and Choices in the case. Ron, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Ron, can you just explain how you became involved in this case?
I was approached because I do some civil rights work, and I think this is a very interesting issue, and worked with Compassion Choices a few years ago. And when they decided to bring a challenge to the residency requirement here in Vermont, we decided to work together again.
Now, we got an email from Joanne in Newberry, and she said, "First, I want to thank Linda for her courage and strength. My heart goes out to you. My question, patients travel between states and in some cases countries for medical treatments. Why is this not considered medical treatment?" Ron?
In my mind, it is considered medical treatment, but I think Diana would be should probably answer this.
Dr. Barnard, why is this not considered medical treatment?
I agree. That's a very good question. And I think we have learned and seen that it is medical treatment. It's not medical treatment that everybody wants to access, but for those who want to, if I am seeing a patient living with a serious cancer and they want to travel out of state to MD Anderson to get a second opinion, we of course support that and understand that patients have a right to seek the care that feels consistent with their personal values and morals. And as I've had experience with this law, I've suddenly come to understand that the same is true for the process of medical aid in dying. It is medical care, and individual patients should have a right to pursue the treatments that feel consistent with their values. I want to, you know, in response to the listener who mentioned that Linda having to move, I agree. I think moving when you're in the midst of a terminal illness is not an easy thing to do. And I don't recommend it because it is burdensome and takes you away from your support system. And I want to make that not necessary. And I still want people to have access for the treatments that they feel are right for them, regardless of the state they live in.
Now, Linda, as a cancer patient, I want to know, are you feeling optimistic about this lawsuit and how and where it's headed?
Optimistic. Well, I'm hopeful. Yeah, I guess I am. I think people are coming around to this point of view that why should the state have an interest in stopping an individual patient with accessing care from a physician wherever they live or wherever they seek treatment. So Vermont is a compassionate state. I chose Vermont as the place where I want to go should it become necessary in the end stage of my disease, because it has a long experience with medical aid in dying. And I think the people of Vermont understand that this is something that's extraordinary. Only 12 states have it in the United States, but something that should be shared.
I want to thank our guest, Linda Bluestein of Bridgeport, Connecticut. Linda, thank you so much for coming on the show and being so vulnerable. I thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, Ron, I want to go to you and discuss the Constitution of all of this. Does the Constitution protect a person's right to die? And how is this lawsuit challenging the Constitution?
Well, this lawsuit is not based on a right to die. There's a Vermont statute that provides that right and sets a procedure for that. What this lawsuit is challenging is the residency requirements, allowing this, but only for Vermont residents. There are three different provisions of the United States Constitution: the Equal Protection Clause, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and the Commerce Clause, that each in different ways say that a state can't discriminate against residents from another state. And that's the legal theory. And that is why we're challenging the residency requirement, which is different from a claim that there's a constitutional right to die.
Now, a similar lawsuit was brought in Oregon and was settled earlier this year. Patient Choices Vermont, which lobbied successfully for Act 39's passage, was quoted in VT Digger as saying that this sets a precedent for the residency requirements. Do you agree with that?
I think it sets a very good example, and the settlement shows that there are serious concerns about the legality of the residency requirement, and that this challenge, could succeed unless we're able to settle with the state of Vermont the way that the settlement took place in Oregon.
I want to go to the phones now, and I want to talk to Lauren in Arlington. Lauren, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, hi. I'm calling from Paulett. Are you speaking with me now?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, great. Oh, thanks for putting me through. So I had a question. My mom was in hospice for 18 months, and it was long and arduous, and at the end of, after she passed away, I actually had become friends with her palliative care doctor, and we met for coffee. And I wanted to ask him why that option was never really offered to her, because she would often ask him, how it was going to be when she died, and her death really wasn't very friendly. And he told me that he felt he didn't want to be seen as the doctor of death. And I'm abbreviating, obviously, our conversation, but essentially, my question is, why are palliative care doctors well informed about, all the steps you have to go to? And obviously, with only 100 people taking this choice for themselves, I mean, it isn't something that people rush to, but it certainly is something that should be offered and explored, particularly with their palliative care doctor.
Thank you for that call, Lauren. And Dr. Barnard, let's go to you and let's hear your thoughts on the conversations and the training that doctors have when it comes to medical aid in dying.
Thank you for that question. I want to first acknowledge and emphasize that particularly for individual patients, this is an option, and it is certainly not anything that is going to be right for everybody. And likewise for physicians. Physicians do have a right to be personally or morally or ethically opposed, or I should say morally, because it is an ethical practice, but morally opposed to participating in the process, and they may choose not to participate. That is okay. However, we also do have an obligation to inform our patients of all of their treatment options. That includes chemotherapy and radiation and treatments for all their other medical problems. And it should also include an open discussion of medical aid in dying for those that meet the criteria. Even though we've had our law since 2013, we are a small state, and sometimes it takes a while for people to have access to information, and we need more information, more education. We want doctors to be fully informed so that they can talk to their patients about all of their options. And I do want to just acknowledge that for some people, it is a sensitive subject. I can't say often enough. Some people know they would want to have this option. Some people know they would never want to have this option. The truth is, in my experience, most people fall in between. So I can imagine that an individual provider might, on the one hand, worry that discussing something might be traumatic to their patient. But I also believe that we have training to be able to carefully listen to what patients are asking for and talk about even the most sensitive and difficult subjects in a professional and appropriate manner. And I hope that going forward, all doctors are able to do this.
Certainly. And let's go back to the phones and let's talk to Doug in Middlebury. Doug, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I'm generally supportive of this. The only thing that concerns me is that the pressure that the patient might be under or might feel that they're under to take this step in order to save their family pain and maybe even expense.
Doug, I'm just curious. Is that pressure to participate in medical aid in dying, or is that pressure not to?
Pressure to participate. In effect, pressure to take their own life in order to save their family.
Dr. Barnard, what can you tell us about how families respond to this choice and the pressure that patients may or may not be under?
I would say, first of all, that there is absolutely no evidence. It's a common concern, but there is absolutely no evidence that patients feel coerced or pressured into exploring this option. I would say that patients and families are doing their very best in incredibly difficult situations. And again, just to acknowledge that we want people to live well and as long as possible. And the truth is that when you are living and dying with a serious illness, it is complicated. It is stressful on families. There is expense involved. And what we're trying to do is deeply listen to what those concerns are, offer every possible solution to help people feel more comfortable so that they want to feel that they can live another day, another week, another month, and also recognize that individuals have their own personal values and that we need to listen to those as well, not to pressure them into making any decision, but to listening to their values and honoring their individual choices.
Now, Ron, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to get your final thoughts when it comes to the legality of this and what you want to make sure that our listeners really take away from this conversation.
You know, disease doesn't recognize state boundaries, and healthcare shouldn't depend on what state you live in. And the Constitution says in the three different ways I mentioned earlier that a state can't discriminate against residents from another state. So we think that the healthcare that's available here should be available to residents. Healthcare is more and more an interstate affair where the University of Vermont hospital system extends into New York. Vermonters go to Dartmouth. It's an interstate affair. And so all residents of all states ought to have equal access to healthcare.
That's attorney Ron Shems. Ron, thank you so much for joining the program and sharing your legal expertise with us.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Barnard, your final thoughts. And actually, I want to ask, and these are probably going to be your final thoughts, where can people go to learn more and for resources on medical aid in dying?
Thank you. The Patient Choices Vermont has a comprehensive website that has information about the process. Compassion and Choices also has wonderful website and resources. And I can certainly connect your listeners with phone numbers for those that do not have internet access. I also just want to emphasize that thank you for doing this show. Keep listening to patients. Remember that more than 85% of people who are terminally ill and use medical aid in dying are on hospice. This is an and situation. We want people to have the best possible end of life care and to honor their individual moral wishes.
That's Dr. Diana Barnard, who practices in Middlebury. Dr. Barnard, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you for having me on.